The following program is intended for mature audiences.
You're listening to Bottom Shelf Recording Talk.
Sounds boring.
Oh my, yes.
With your hosts, James Seabrook.
That's not at all what I meant. My brain is going to jump from one thing to another. I know I'm lecturing here. This is ridiculous because I don't listen to my own lectures half the time.
And Joey Roach.
Annoying. I have to keep the asshole within. Like, I don't know how I figured that out by myself.
I'd like to think that this is going to be edited.
I can't even talk.
Where was I going with that?
People get angry at me a lot.
You're such a dork.
You keep using the word. I don't think it means what you think it means.
By the way, you know, when you're telling these little stories,
you have a big mouth.
Here's a good idea.
What are you even talking about?
That was my favorite episode.
Have a point.
Why are you airing personal matters with complete strangers?
It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
Because I got these things.
And hello, hello, hello. Welcome back to episode 12 of the Bottom Shelf Recording Talk.
Are you already Bottom at Shelf? 12?
Yeah, this is already this episode is 12.
You know, I heard someone say that they were having trouble downloading it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I probably shouldn't bring that up.
No, that's that. We need to know those kind of things so we can fix them.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. We have today, for the first time ever on the podcast, we have a guest. And I'd like to welcome Glenn Allen, mastering engineer in Edmonton, Alberta. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Excellent. Excellent. Now, we've been talking a lot already this morning. And I want to ask a bunch about some of the stories that you've brought up, but first I want to get while we have people listening attentively, because Joey and I tend to tangent quite a bit, and I'm sure we must lose 90% of our audience when we tangent. I want to talk first about paradox mastering and what it is that you're currently doing, so that everybody knows who you are and what you do and why you're here.
Okay. Well, I left the scene for a long time. Basically, I was going nuts. I had a studio back in the 90s, Machine Room. It was Corey Johnson's first effort at putting together a studio. And it changed hands a bunch of times. And we tried to keep it open. But in the 90s, the economy was really bad. But the advantage was that rent was pretty cheap.
Yeah, we were talking about
vacancies,
that, yeah.
Vacancies everywhere. So that was a bonus. The overhead was low, but nobody had any money,
Sounds like, today.
Yeah, well, and the competition is insane. Like, back then, there was Beta Sound, Damon, and a couple others.
Homestead was a big hitter in town. Yeah. And
yeah, but now there's like 50 really good facilities.
Last I counted in 2012, we were over 60.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and like, and it's the studios,
it just blows my mind.
Studios that I would consider something that are professional-ish and trying to make money. Right. And,
yeah.
And that doesn't even count all the guys that have, and girls, because I know there's a lot of girls that have home studios too,
which is great,
that have really great home setups.
Yeah.
But they might not necessarily like I don't count Joey's setup because
I don't count it either.
It's well, Joey's,
it's
Joey's
my
setup
personal
is,
space, really.
And, okay. And it's a,
I
it's
do
a,
work
it's
in
a
there,
mixed
but I don't
space in your living room.
Let people rent it.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's your lab.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I like the term lab.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah, I do too.
Like
yeah.
Geeking out on the science.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell us about paradox mastering.
Well, I went to see Q. He was in Dolly Rotten and 12th House back in the day. And
right.
He was working with Will Belcourt and the Hollywood Indians, and they asked me to master, and I prefer it to mixing because it's less pressure. Mm-hmm. It's the last 10% of the project. And I said, yes, I would do it. And he ended up winning the 2015 Indigenous Music Awards for best rock album, even though it's not really a rock album. but no, he did really well with it. From there, probably because of the award, the phone started ringing.
Nice.
So I just kept going. Last month I did Young Medicine, another.
I saw that one released. Yeah.
Back in the day, I worked with, let me see here, Northwest Passage, probably names nobody even remembers, like QED.
I know that as a medical device.
Okay. Moberg, Pursuit of Happiness.
Yeah.
Did a little bit with them.
Very cool.
I worked with Gary McDonald at Damon.
Yeah.
It's now the audio department.
Right. Gary mastered the first album that I ever...
did he?
I ever recorded and produced.
Yeah, he loved doing post work. Yeah. And there's a lot more money in it too, I think. Especially if you're talking about synchronization and video.
Right.
Know? Yeah. Right. Which is kind of off topic, but yeah.
I think if you're looking at a career in mastering, mm-hmm. Which you're doing right now,
yeah.
you have to not limit yourself. You can't limit yourself to just music. You have to be open to and understand the different needs of, right. And I think that's the big, I definitely want to get into this later on, but I think that's one of the big differences between mastering your own music, the guys that do it at home, the guys that aren't professional mastering guys.
Yeah.
And then those that are professional mastering engineers, they understand the whole breadth of
different genres,
different mediums,
different formats, yeah.
Different markets. Requirements.
Absolutely. I mean, it goes on and on. You know, a lot of people think, yeah, well, why can't I just throw a plugin in, you know, Isotope, and I'm a mastering engineer.
I set up a preset and hit play.
Yeah. You know, pick a preset and it's done. Just slap a limiter on it. And in some cases, if the mix engineer did his job, there's nothing I can do to enhance some things because they're so well done. They're mixed so well. You mid-side the thing. And I mean, you can remove the vocals completely.
Right.
Like just by mid-siding and you know, okay, well, this was mixed. It's so balanced. You slap a limiter on it and yeah, that it's done.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen very often.
No.
Usually there's some polishing to be done. And I mean, metadata has to be embedded. Those codes we were talking about
SRC
are
codes.
Really important because, listen, kids, you don't want to leave any money on the table.
Right.
You got to have those codes. So
yeah. Well, and a good mastering engineer will, in the setup conversations before the mastering even happens, he will be asking, do I need to be encoding the metadata or will that be part of another process? Right. Cause I work with a mastering engineer out of Winnipeg that asks me that question all the time.
I forget his name. He's Grammy
Sitar. Yeah. And he does fantastic work.
Oh, amazing.
And he asks me when it's appropriate, you know, am I doing the metadata or am I sending this back to you, James? And are you doing the metadata? And oftentimes that's the case is in order to save money for the client, Jamie will master, send me back just the digital files and I'll do all the encoding.
Right.
Because
he's going to charge a fee to put all that data in there, embed all of it.
Right. Cause it's extra work. You're asking for that extra work to be done.
Yeah.
So, we had a brief conversation about names and business names and that kind of thing a couple weeks ago. Where did Paradox Mastering, the name, come from?
Oh boy. I wasn't expecting that question.
Singer.
Well, you know, it's really confusing because my site that is still under construction, it's stellarrecordscanada.wordpress.com or something like that. Okay, originally it was going to be Stellar, but there is already a number of Stellar Records.
Mm.
And I didn't want to trample on them. there's already a Paradox Media, one in Australia and one in the States. Paradox actually came from my old guitar player.
Oh,
he always uses the word. He's kind of hung up on it. It stuck with me. And originally it was Paradox Collective, collective being sort of the group of people that I deal with, right?
Right.
And then I just moved it to Paradox Mastering and it kind of stuck. And that's what it is now.
Perfect. Okay. Yeah. And we'll finish up here with the mastering side, the business side. What services specifically do you offer to our local market? And I know you're beyond local, but to our local home producers, small studios, big studios in Edmonton, what are you offering?
I can finish the last stage of the process, which is the mastering. Mm-hmm. I lend an objective ear, which is what really it's all about. It's an objective ear, someone who hasn't been there, isn't close to the project anymore. Like when you're recording, you've heard the song how many thousands of times, you know, you can't be objective at that point. You have to hand it off to somebody.
Right.
So I'm that guy, I guess, is the short answer.
Cool. Sweet. Okay. So, when we started talking about having you on this show, mm-hmm. the thing that you really wanted to get into was what is mastering and getting our listeners specifically to a point where they understand what they, I'm trying to remember how you put it, what they need to know to give you what you need to get the most out of their recordings.
Well, I think one thing that it isn't is, like we were just saying, it's not throwing on a limiter. What I need is for your master bus to never go over -6,
right,
or thereabouts. Give me some headroom. That's really key. I need headroom or I can't do nothing with it.
Right.
If you give me something and you're like, you've got limiters on your master bus, I can't, there's not much I can do. You know, I get that a lot. and I mean, it's like, I have to just talk to the mix engineer usually and say, you know, if you want me to master it, why did you start the process of mastering? Because that's really what you're doing by slapping a limiter on your master bus.
Yeah.
So I try to talk to either the mix engineer or the artist or whoever it is and tell them that I need headroom. Like, that's really key. I need that headroom or I can't do what I do, which is really, I heard one person put it this way. It's like, if your music is like a painting, I'm the guy that puts the lighting and the frame on it and sprays the gloss over top of it. That's one analogy that I really liked.
Cool.
So yeah,
I've used something similar with my students to get them to understand what mastering is.
Yeah.
And I've used the Photoshop because all my students are super young, right?
Right.
So I use the Photoshop analogy where your recording, your mixing is framing the shot, making sure the subject material of the picture is perfect, what you need, and you take the shot.
Yeah.
And it is, like, that is your art. Like, what you do framing, what you do focus-wise, what you do lighting-wise, at the moment you take that picture, that's the recording, that's the mix. Editing and performance is all that stuff, right? And then the mastering is kind of the Photoshop stage where it's,
yes,
where it's
finishing.
It's just enhancing the color, enhancing the contrast,
or sometimes hiding,
or sometimes
what's bad.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. You enhance what's good.
And just like in Photoshop, there's a lot of crossover you can have in the editing stage. You know, maybe you need to repair a blemish in a cheek. That's part of the editing stage, right? That's part of you as the photographer making it, you know. But all the all that fine enhancement right at the end, you know, that's kind of the mastering stage.
And what it's not is mixing. And I have even fallen into it where you're trying to fix something that is not a really good recording. It's not balanced. It's not, you know, and you find yourself, even as a mastering guy, you find yourself trying to mix it. And you, I mean, you're working with two channels, you know,
I found myself recently firing mastering guys because they'll ask for stems. And I've made the policy that if you ask me for stems, I fire you on the spot.
Well, there is a new trend in stem mastering, but it's usually genre specific.
Yeah, but I know why they're asking for them, and it's because they're trying to change my mix, which I was paid to do the mix.
Yeah, it's right. Yeah.
So I'm saying, no, you're not mastering that because you're going to change what we've already signed off on.
Yeah.
And when you deal with those guys, how much of their response is based on them thinking there's an issue? Because I've had a number of mastering engineers back in my early days that would say, okay, I need you to turn down the kick. I need you to turn down 200 hertz on the snare.
And if they would approach it like
that's
that,
rude.
I would.
Well, I wasn't always very good.
Well, yeah, but you know,
I don't know. If a mastering guy tells me, you know, hey, you got some trouble in the low end or something like that, I'm gonna go back to the mix and fix it.
I guess what you're saying is
they're automatically saying, hey, give me the stems, because then there's, I don't know, they hear a problem. Just tell me what it is.
Yeah.
Well, low end is always where the problems are. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of information down there, and it your environment is really important.
I've taken this approach a couple times, and I don't do nearly as much mastering as you do, but I get probably a dozen mastering gigs a year. And I've taken this approach a couple times with some guys that I know are pretty green at the mixing side of things. I will ask for stems. I'll try to go about it in a really nice way. but I'll say something like, it'd be really great if you could separate this song into the instrumental and just send me the instrumental, and then send me the vocal tracks and just send me the vocal tracks. Because I can go back and I can fix a little more of the elements, you know, and I don't want to change the mix, right?
Unless it's a really shitty mix.
But if it's a really shitty mix, and even breaking it down just into the instrumental and the vocals, then a lot of times there's nothing you can do anyway.
Yeah.
You have to go back to the mix engineer and say, okay, I have some notes on your mix that I want you to consider, and then get back to me after you've considered them.
It's kind of a touchy thing, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah.
Some guys, maybe not in my circle,
because my circle, there's a lot of us who all ask each other for feedback like
Yeah, like I would never master my stuff.
I have been out because too many people ask for the stems from me, and I know what they're doing. Yeah. So I've been
mastering
my own material.
I would... If I was really close to my own material and I had mixed it and wrote it and the rest of it, I would send it off to Sweet Sound in Vancouver or somebody like that.
Right.
Like, it's just, don't master your own stuff.
I think for the no budget guys, I think some of them have to look at the option.
Yes. Fair enough. But you know, my rates are really, really reasonable.
do you mind talking about that kind of thing on air?
I don't mind at all.
What are your rates for mastering?
You know, it's gotten so competitive.
Mm.
The way I like to put it is, I can work with any budget.
Nice. Okay.
So I'll just leave it at that.
It really depends. Fair,
yeah. Right? You know, we can negotiate. It's so competitive. I mean... Mm. There's guys using Lander. We haven't talked about that.
Well, see, now I've heard good and bad things come out of Lander too.
Yeah, me too. I've even stuck some stuff through it. And I mean, if you're in a crunch and you've got an unreasonable timeline, and if it's straight ahead, poppy kind of stuff, Lander isn't just a limiter. I did some research on it because, I mean, Lander came out right when I was thinking of going into this.
Oh, yeah.
Which, again, was about 3 years ago. I mean, I have previous experience mixing and stuff like that. But, right. Yeah. So I was thinking, oh, great. Technology is just going to take this job.
It's going to take my job.
Yeah,
work at McDonald's anyway.
You know, which would be fine. That's okay. But at any rate, I looked into it, and they're using artificial intelligence. Mm-hmm. So it does a really good job as long as it's straight ahead stuff. If it's something a little quirky, yeah, it doesn't do a good job at all.
I find if it does anything, because I work a lot in like heavy rock and metal kind of area.
Right.
It doesn't work at all with that.
No. I'm talking pop.
Yeah.
Like if it's pop, if it's straight ahead, you know, it can handle it. And they say that they're going to improve it. And you mean, back then, you just had no choice. You put your music in and it spit something out. And for $5, I think it was.
15 a month.
Oh, have they upped it? Yeah. Well, and they've added a sensitivity thing, I think, so you can adjust it a bit. Yep. They were talking about doing that, I don't know, a year ago.
And I think it was about a year ago, maybe a little more, that feature came out.
Yeah.
I need to be talking to the microphone. Yeah, so it was about a year, maybe a year and a half ago. Online blogger Ian Shepherd, who's a mastering engineer out of the UK, he did.
Those guys are really good.
He did an actual comparison of his own master being really aggressive, medium aggressive, and really light.
Right.
Compared to Lander being really aggressive, because their three settings are heavy, heavy, medium, and light.
Yeah.
And he said that while he preferred his masters over the Lander masters at all three categories, he said the medium setting, he was really surprised at how well it did. And he was doing a, like a rock and roll kind of U2-ish master.
Right.
That was the song.
Right.
And so
Poppy, probably
pop rock type of thing. Yeah. He was very
surprised?
Positively surprised.
Positively surprised.
He said, he kind of said the same thing you did. It does really good if your expectations aren't really, really specific, because obviously it's you can't give it specific instructions.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And it'll never be a replacement for, or it'll probably never be a replacement for the human element.
No,
right.
The human
ability to make unique decisions at every stage.
But, yeah.
But he said for guys that are doing low budget stuff and that need their stuff mastered, he said it was a very reasonable opportunity. I'd love to hear something similar, Joey, with all three stages, with something that you've done, just something heavy, something more aggressive.
Yeah.
To see if one of
the last time I tried Lander, it didn't have the three stages.
Okay.
It was when it first came out, but I just haven't ever heard anything aggressive come out of Lander that sounded really well.
Yeah, no, I've heard that. I've heard that.
That's right.
I've heard if you throw anything really different at it, it has a hard time coping.
Even CD Baby now has added it to their list of recommended services.
Disc makers has allied with a mastering outfit. Which, you know, that's okay. I have a guy at Disc Makers that I deal with. He's a great guy. Blake, really great guy.
Right.
He got Young Medicine stuff. Their turnaround times are insane.
That good.
They are so fast. And they've been doing it since 1949. Like,
nice.
And vinyl's coming back. Which is really...
That's a whole different ballgame.
That's a whole other story. Yeah, and that, yeah, well, that's, yeah.
Something I would like to learn is how to master for vinyl.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I imagine it's a completely different beast.
That's where it all started. That's a little bit of the history of mastering. That's where it all began. I got the guys that cut. They literally said, well, you know, I think I could improve on this a little.
It didn't start with improving. It started with, okay, there's too much low end in this. It's making the needle bounce.
Needle pop off.
We need to reduce this.
Right. So they threw a piece of gear before cutting and they lowered the low end, but then they added more gear.
And that's when they started to realize
the birth of mastering.
Not only can we correct this low end thing that's making the needle bounce, we can make this sound better.
Yes. Yeah. And a new area was opened up. And it's good. And I mean, admittedly, it's a small part of the whole project, but it's that last 10%. And, you know, I had a real hard time sometimes finishing a project. Like, you know what I mean? You get into it, you mix and mix and mix. And I'm a bit of a perfectionist, which I think as a mastering engineer is a good thing. Unless you have a really unreasonable deadline, you know. But, so handing something off to somebody to finish so you can send it off and get your CDs or whatever you're pressing, for me would have been ideal, you know. But back then, I didn't have the budget for a mastering guy and that kind of thing, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and
I was doing other people's stuff. Finding time to do your own material, I mean, forget it. You know,
I think we've all been there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I have so much work with everyone else.
Yeah.
But I can't make any time for myself.
No, you can't. I mean, yeah. But that's okay. That's okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, was there anything else you wanted to include about the mastering?
One thing I wanted to touch on was I'm really surprised at experienced guys recording at 44.1.
Okay.
Now, I know this is a big...
I record at 48.
Record at 48?
Slightly.
I record at 48.
48.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's better than nothing.
Well,
I know people say, well, Glenn... Nobody can hear past 22 hertz or whatever.
And that's not even why I do it. Okay. But carry on, because I want to hear this.
I did a blog on this because it just drives me nuts. Okay, I was working at 44.1 for a long time. And when I switched to 96, I noticed that not all of them, but a lot of my plugins... I mean, just everything came to life for me. I mean, to my ears, some people claim they can't hear the difference.
And some people probably can't.
Yeah, fair enough. I sure can hear the difference. I mean, if something was sampled at 44.1 and you go to 96, maybe you can't. But I mean, certain.
Not a fair test, though.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah. So, but I mean, yeah, if you track at 96, what happens is you're capturing harmonics that, yeah, they go outside of what the human ear can hear, but they're reflected inside of the range that you can hear. If you don't capture things at the highest possible resolution, then you're missing all that fat sounding harmonic energy, you know?
I have a great comparable that non-tech people will really understand.
Right.
I had a wonderful piano player come in, and I have a terrible piano.
It's not that bad. I played it. Came in here. I didn't check at all.
We don't record it anymore. That's
I see. Okay.
But what we do have is we have a really nice Roland stage piano that has really nice samples. The keys are weighted and they feel really nice. And
RD-800 or something.
The 300. The 300X, 300GX.
Is it the 300? I thought it was the 800.
It's the 300.
There's nothing like a real piano, though.
Well, and I started. The girl came in. She played on this stage piano, and she just made one tiny little comment that stuck in the back of my ear. So at the end of the session, I asked her, what, you made this comment, what do you mean?
Yeah.
And she said that even though this digital piano with its samples sounds really good, and she admitted it sounds really good,
yeah,
it was missing one tiny little thing that a real piano always gives her, and that was the vibration of the wood of the piano resonating into the keys and into her fingers. Mm-hmm. And it was, yeah, it was the kind of thing that I had never considered, never thought of as something important until I started thinking, well, yeah, I've played some MIDI guitars with plastic strings.
Right.
And it's just kind of goofy and weird.
Yes.
Right. It still sounds, sounded
okay,
fine.
But it's thin, right? That, well, you know, I remember when I got into synths, cause I'm a keyboard guy, and I had a real high top piano in the basement. That's where it all started. I loved that piano. Came home one day years later and it was gone, but that's a whole other story. And, you know, I had to lean on samples and the synths and try to get musicality out of that. You know, years go by and I am just dying for a real piano. And I know, right, you can get them for free because people, I mean, it's a piece of, they give it away. Yeah, get it out of here. Which, when I get the space, I really have to get back to that, because once you lose that, I mean, and it's gone for a long time, and you try, like I've tried getting the best samples, multi-samples, and it's just not the same. It just isn't the same.
Yeah.
And it's sort of the same thing, like why I wanted to touch on tracking at the highest possible sample rate, because, right, you're going to get a thicker, fatter sound. And already we're dealing with digital, so it's already going to sound thinner than like back in the days of tape and analog, which is a warmer, fatter sound. I mean, there's just no getting around it, you know?
See, and I actually completely disagree with you.
Okay,
I'm not disagreeing about the sample rate being, and all those harmonics that you can't hear
reflecting,
playing in.
Yeah, no,
but
you can't disagree with that because that's science.
Right, exactly, right?
You know.
But the feel that tape was warmer, tape was bigger and fatter, I disagree with, because there are the technology, the digital technology has come so far that I don't think, if you're using quality equipment, quality tape gear, because there's lots of shitty tapes out there.
Yes,
shitty tape machines. Yeah. And quality converters, quality...
Your whole chain.
If your whole chain is quality,
yeah,
I don't think there is enough significant difference because the workflow, I think, is far more important. You know, like the instrument in front of the microphone.
Well, the music itself.
Exactly, yeah, right? Yeah. And I think at the end of the day, if the right people are playing the right music and the right people are making the judgments on the music,
yeah.
And I think the end product will be just as warm and probably different for different reasons.
Right.
Than because it's digital or because it's tape.
I'm being really nitpicky because I come from both worlds and I'm all digital. Like, but, if you have the budget, you know, I'll go to Sound Extractors or maybe even here and pump stuff through analog gear to warm up your master. But, you know, I'll give you what you're saying, but there's advantages and disadvantages to both. And it depends on the music.
Sure.
If you're recording opera, okay, if I had a Studer or even a Tascam with DBX, I would rather record it in tape because it's vocals. And there's something musical about, especially, I just love DBX noise reduction. There's something about it that
well,
I don't think they're trying to create plugins that emulate it, and it's not just a 2-to-1 compression ratio. There's more going on, but at any rate, yeah, yeah. I'm having trouble letting go of the past, I guess.
See, my first recordings were all on tape. I didn't start recording on computer until I'd been doing it for 4, maybe 5 years. And I don't miss, like, even though computers,
so many,
like,
advantages, yeah, to digital. I know.
I don't miss tape in the slightest. To the fact that I will absolutely try to talk a client out of doing it on tape, unless they have a really good reason.
Good artistic reason. Right? Yeah. Okay.
At that point, I mean, they also have to have the budget for it. Right.
Cause
we're set up to bring in, a deck. I have one main guy in town that has a bunch of tape machines that he rents out.
Black Box?
No.
I gotta look for his card.
Real Audio Productions.
Real, eh? Yeah, well, no, I mean, it's linear too, right? And that's a real disadvantage in the world of digital, I think. And I mean, there are so many advantages to digital that, I mean, tape, yeah, is going to go the way of the...
I actually think it's going to stay around. I think it's going to be one of those things that it's probably died off for a little bit now, but it's
going to be like vinyl.
Yeah.
It's going to be a niche thing for a while, and then it might come back like years from now.
I like that you put in the qualifier of might. I hope it does.
I can't predict the future.
I hope it does. I know that there's guys, like, I think the guy at Black Box who I just met.
Steve McGonagall.
He's pretty stressed out, I think.
He's gone through so many, like, all the water that he's had in his place over the last 3 years. My God, I don't wish that on anybody.
No, he told me about that. Yeah, luckily the gear was up above the water line when he had his floods.
That's one of the reasons I have this big box down underneath everything.
Yep.
Just to raise it up, worst case scenario, because we've had a couple of rainstorms.
Yeah.
Where the parking lot flooded, and I was worried that it was going to get up over the stair line or the step line.
Oh man.
And might sneak into the studio, and I just. Yeah.
Yeah. No. Well, he's down below underneath, and there's reasons for that, because he's kind of hidden away, and the amount of gear he's got in there, you know, I don't blame him for kind of being hidden away.
Yeah.
A lot of studios do that, you know, or they're in the back.
Like Beta. You would never know that place exists.
Yeah. There's a lot of studios around the world that do that kind of...
Yeah.
You don't know that they're in there behind that wall. But he's got a tape machine in there. I think it's a Studer. I'm not sure. And I asked him, you know, have you ever ran stuff through it, like digital stuff, to try to warm it up or whatever? And he said, no. He's thought about it.
Yeah.
But his answer was no.
I bought the UAD Studer for warming up. Tape machine.
I have a lot of I've got Waves plugins for tape, and I just think it's funny that they're creating these plugins and these models, these algorithms to try to emulate what, you know.
I'm also regarded pretty weird by my friends because I'm like the strange guy who's slowly building an analog rig. Everybody else is getting rid of their analog and I'm the one like, hey, I'll take it.
You know, it blows my mind that the price of like an 808 at one point was like, people were like, you could find them at pawn shops, and the big explode, like I was into synths before they were sexy. You know, Trent Reznor made them sexy again. And, well, for the first time ever, I think. And then they became sexy, and then EDM and the rave scene, and now it's just crazy. But yeah, I was into it before it was, you know, interesting and popular.
So let's go back to the sample rate thing.
Right. So bottom line, when you're tracking, track at the highest possible sample rate that you can. without getting into technical specifics, it's you're going to end up with the better sounding production, I think.
Fair enough. So I actually did some research when I switched from 44, when I had my home studio, to 48, and I switch. 48 when I opened my first studio, back in 2003, and I did some research then, couldn't find a reason, but I heard a difference, yeah. and I just wanted to make a tiny move up, yeah. but I could hear a difference, and part of that was I'm sure the sample rate, but also part of that was I didn't realize in those early days that my home stuff was recording at 16 bit, just didn't know.
Right. Right. And now we have floating point 32.
Yeah. Right. Joey is a big fan of that.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you can clip your channels and it doesn't matter.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it doesn't matter. It gives you that little more, and that's an awful sounding distortion. Whereas, you know, it's completely turned on its head, and I'm sure it'll happen again because it's audio and you never stop learning because there's so much to learn. But it used to be, you know, back in the day, you would try to get everything as hot as you could.
Right.
Whereas now, you try to get everything as soft
moderate
as you, yeah, because yeah. There's no noise floor, some... right? Like everything is digital, so it's yeah.
Again. I think that's another misconception about the noise floor is everything has a noise floor. Even your converters have a noise floor. There's noise in everything. So I think it's important to have, just like in the old days, you wanted to try to get as hot as you can. Nowadays, I think it's important to be in that middle to upper middle range, but be aware that you're not going too hot because digital clipping sucks.
Yes.
But also yeah. not going too quiet, because if you record something at like minus 40 digital, then you're turning up all that noise floor that probably starts at minus 60.
Yeah.
Which is only 20 decibels below what you're actually recording. And by the time you turn that up, suddenly you have a shit ton of noise.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm starting to swear more on the podcast. We need to start a swear jar is what we need to do. Is that?
I don't know.
Fuck one.
We had that one episode where I beeped every swear word and I stopped after that one episode.
Do you edit this?
I used to.
We used to, yeah. Now we go completely live.
Yeah, because
no
takes
editing
too long.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. We would. Joey would literally spend 16 hours going through and editing.
Wow.
But I think those first three.
I was
three...
going nuts though, and I would like every lip smack. I would be editing.
Yeah.
De-essing manually.
You were de-essing. Oh. Wow.
Now what we have is we spent. We made a point at about episode 6 or something, maybe episode 8. To stop being so time consuming.
I didn't even know that you guys had so many, like I thought the last one was the first one.
Yeah, no, the last one was episode 11.
Yeah.
You probably heard episode 10.
So this is episode 12. 12.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
12.
Yeah. This is the first episode in probably 3 or 4 where we've actually had a purpose to the episode.
Yeah, the last couple have been just.
And why bottom shelf?
I don't remember how we came up with. I think you came up with that.
Yeah, we were throwing around a whole
kind
bunch of ideas.
Self-deprecating, isn't it?
Yeah, but I mean, both of us are kind of self-deprecating kind of people anyway.
Yeah,
and so
me too.
Like, yeah. We beat the snot out of each other, and we beat the snot out of ourselves.
Yeah,
and of course, a bottom shelf. Well, that's just all the low end stuff.
Right.
Right.
So right.
We're thinking
yeah.
like this is perfect. It's yeah. Yeah.
And maybe, you know, maybe that's why there are so many studios that are actually surviving, is because everybody is making their own music. You know, I kind of think that is the future, that everybody will just create their own music. That is the future of music.
I don't disagree with you. I think because it's opened up so much. But are you forecasting like kind of?
Well,
the,
I'm not forecast. I'm just
no.
musing.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
I'm not saying that that's what's going to happen. I'm just, you know.
I've completely 180'd on the idea of the home studio and everybody having their own studio being the death of recording studios. I hate
thinking that.
Well, and I don't actually believe it anymore.
No.
Having
the
gone
evidence,
through
how many studios did you say we're at in this 60 town?
60 something, yeah.
Wow.
Well, and that's the thing is I think because of the proliferation of easy home recording,
yeah,
it's creating this generation of people who are willing to spend a little bit more, and studio prices are coming down,
yes,
because the competition is so fierce. But
yeah,
it's creating this generation of people who understand that they can't do it to their level of expectation at home,
right,
and they need to branch out. There will always be geniuses out there that can do amazing work, but I have at least half a dozen clients from 2015 alone that started out as guys that recorded themselves at home,
yeah,
that have turned into educated clients that know what they want, know they either don't have the patience or don't have the skill or don't have the time to learn the skill to get good at recording and mixing. And so they bring their projects to a moderately priced studio like this one.
Yeah.
Bulk of my clients, most of them all have home studios, and they'll record at home and then they send it to me to mix because
they want something professional.
They want your ears.
Yeah.
And I think because of that, the really big studios are the ones that are going to suffer.
Yeah.
Because budgets are just going down everywhere. But the ones that will survive and the medium studios like this that remain competitive.
Yeah.
I think they'll survive.
I think they will
quite
too.
Well, because
it mostly because of what you've done to it, the environment, right? Is
right.
So important. Being comfortable, which you've achieved, by the way. Like, this is, everybody has to record here. Like, this is a wonderful place.
Thank you very much.
But at any rate, yeah. A guy at Long McQuaid, his name escapes me.
Me. No. I don't think it was me.
Southside.
I am Southside.
Oh, are you? I've seen you in there.
I'm in rentals most of the time.
Oh, you're behind. Okay. He's from Vancouver. He came out here. Anyways, it doesn't matter who he is. Ken.
Oh, yeah, Ken.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ken.
Oh, yes, of course, Ken. I have no idea who Ken is.
Ken's a big guy.
He's a nice guy. He's been really good to me. He's told me not to buy certain things because
he tells everybody not to buy certain things.
Well, yeah, but the thing is it was a really stupid thing for me to have bought. Like, it made no sense for me to buy this particular thing.
What was it?
It was more converters. What do I need more freaking converters for? You know.
That was probably his reasoning too, bro.
Well, right? It was, you know, I just wanted to buy something, you know, I had paid off my account. So,
well, yeah, that happened to me recently. I had my account paid off and of course I work there. So it's just like temptation.
It is.
And then I bought two guitars, one of which recently got lobotomized.
You use your Personas, little fader thing.
Port?
Do you use that a lot for your automation and stuff?
Not as much.
As you used to, or
well, no, but before we installed the Soundcraft console, we had the Mackie
MCU
units, and we had 24 faders, and we used those a lot,
yeah,
a ton for automation. I would pretty much use that for automation, and then fine tune with the mouse.
Do you still have your MCUs, or
you do? I still have them. They're in storage upstairs.
And you want to sell them to me, right?
I'm actually, we can talk.
Are they the ones that will upgrade to the latest firmware, or are they the old ones that won't?
No, they're the ones that will upgrade, yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll talk. We definitely will talk.
Is there other firmware out for the MCUs?
I think 4.3 is the last.
Yeah.
Yeah. Last upgrade.
It'll be the last.
Once you have them already installed?
Yeah, they're already upgraded to 4.3, yeah.
There's one at Long McQuaid, but I did my homework and found out that it's the older model, and it won't upgrade to the new firmware. It has different motorized faders or something.
I noticed that the faders were different on that particular one.
The used one that's in there?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
Like, I felt, I was playing with it, and it just feels weird.
Whereas you and I think both have the newer versions.
Yeah.
Joey's got the MCUs at home, too.
It's different hardware in there.
Apparently. Yeah, yeah,
and that's why the firmware won't work on the old one, right? Anyways,
yeah,
yeah.
Be fair, I don't like the feel of that one that we have at my store anyway.
Yeah, no, it hasn't moved.
It feels weird.
I thought it was gonna I was all excited because the price was so good.
It is a good price.
It's
for a reason.
But the thing that I don't like about it is the feel of the faders.
Yeah.
See, and I don't mind the feel of the fader ports faders, the Presonus. But it's just one.
Yeah, I know.
And and that really bugs me. Like if I'm gonna do automation, like when I do automation on drums, I'm playing it.
You're
like
playing the board,
right?
Like
this one up a little bit, this one down, all this, you know, and I can't do that here. I have to do one pass at a time.
Yeah.
Which I would actually rather write it in with the mouse.
Yeah.
That's what I tell people at work, because they're like, why do you need more? Because I told them I was thinking about buying another extension to extend to 24 channels. They're like, what do you need 24 channels for? Automation, man. Have you ever automated with more than one fader?
So nice.
That's what Ken was saying too. Just going back to what you were saying about the survival of these studios is like you go in with a band, you track in a good studio with good treatment, acoustical treatment, and you take your project home. And that's where I see the studios surviving, for the tracking to capture the drums, especially the drums.
We've had a lot of clients over the years that have actually used this place specifically for that.
They go home and mix it.
Yeah, they'll go home and record guitars because
do their
guitar
overdubs.
Sims are so good.
Yeah,
and basses and sometimes they'll do vocals. I've had some that
and then
come
they'll
back
come back
to
here
vocals.
To master it.
And then they'll come back to master. Some guys even come back to
Or they come to me to master it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Shit. Oh, subtle.
But I think that's a lot of what the home studio market is creating is
a big demand for that.
Yeah. And now that we have the console, it makes it even easier for anybody to walk in because we have the console set up. This is one of the I really pushed for this, and Joey saw how much I stressed over these kind of things. We had the console for almost 3 months before we actually installed.
He was plotting out how he's going to wire everything for those 3 months.
I think
and testing
was it,
everything.
Was it you that I seen? I don't think it was you. Maybe it was you. You had all the paperwork. Out. You were all the charts and
it
was you.
We pulled out every single channel one at a time to inspect it, to make sure that everything was good. Yeah. We had notations on all the knobs. So I can look back at those notes and tell you exactly which three, there's two knobs and one button that aren't working right on the whole 52 channels.
I won't be rude and ask you what you invested, but
that's all good. But the biggest thing that we did was we wanted to make sure that those guys that don't care about consoles can still come in and have 48 channels of preamps and an EQ attached to it, and they can bypass the console entirely. We even have it set up so that if you wanted, you can turn off, you can leave the console powered down and still use the studio entirely. You just lose those 48 channels of preamps. We still have 14 channels of preamps that are all really great quality, from API to Neve to new Neve.
Yeah, I know. I'm looking over there and I'm salivating. Yeah.
But we did that so that worst case scenario, old analog gear dies, the board dies, or someone comes in, doesn't want to use the board. I have a client coming in April, has no desire to even touch the board. He wants to be able to put his keyboard on the console because it makes a good desk. And not piano keyboard, his typing keyboard.
Oh, okay. I was going to say he's putting his synthesizer on your desk.
but not worry about the console at all.
Right.
He runs about 10, 12 channels of drums, wants to track drums for the metal record that he's doing, and then bugger off and do the rest at home.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. That's good. That's got to be the reason
you're going to love this too. We even have it set up so that you can bring in your own computer.
Yeah. With your software and your plug.
You want to bring in your laptop and record using our rooms and our microphones and our outboard
acoustics.
USB connection. That's all you need.
That's all you need. Yeah, yeah.
We have it set up so that you can be 32 in, 32 out.
3.0.
Your software. 3.0 if you want.
Yeah.
But you can
be 2.0 too, right?
Can be 2.0 as well. You bet. Yeah, and
you've made
and that
it
was
really easy.
Just being able to bypass the headaches that most inexperienced guys have when they go to a different computer.
You ask them for something and they're like, "Well, what is that?" Yeah. You've made it really. Yeah, that's really smart. That's really smart. And you know, there are some places, I won't mention any names, sound extractors, but they sure don't make you feel comfortable. I mean, the one guy does, the other guy doesn't, you know, and it's like, okay, I'm paying, well, in my case, I don't pay a lot, but I'm paying and you're being such a prick to me. It's like, I'm keeping your lights on. I'm keeping your doors open and you're treating me like a freaking dick. Like, I can't believe it. But anyways, I had to get that off my chest. Sorry.
No worries.
But yeah, no, and I'm not the only one. Actually, it was Ken that told me that story. Because, I mean, there are guys that, like you say, they track in a good studio like this one. And then they take it home. They mix it. And then they go either to another studio or the same studio and they master it. And then that's got to be why there's so many studios and they're all staying alive.
Well, they're all finding ways to keep overhead down as much as possible.
Yeah.
And speaking of that, I'd really love to hear about your experiences because Velveteen Audio, who you spent some time with his new SSL not too long ago.
Yeah.
I would love. I don't know much about Brad.
I don't know a lot about him either. He's a super guy.
I've never been to his studio, but I've seen pictures, and of course that SSL looks fantastic.
It's a cozy space. He's really great guy, but that I know, and I call it production therapy. He's got this thing that he does every month where he's basically dissecting or not dissecting, but he's like picking people's brains, songwriters, producers.
Right.
And he sits there with his notebook and he's just getting all the little gems from people. And he's very smart to do that, I think. He's really smart to do that. Plus, it's great networking. It's great promotion for his facility. He's a smart guy.
Right.
But I asked him, you know, how do you keep your doors open? Because back when I had the machine room, I mean, yeah, sure, our costs were really low, but like I said,
you still went bankrupt.
We sure did. Literally, lost it all because, you know, I really wanted to keep it open because I just figured something's got to give, you know, if I kind of seen the trend coming and it wasn't long after we went bankrupt. Where I call it the audio revolution happened, or it started to hit, and all these places opened up. And yeah, I mean, I could go into details, and it's quite the story, but the book's coming out soon. But yeah,
are you actually writing a book?
Well, you know, I was thinking about it because no one would believe the story. But yeah, I mean, there was 90 days in jail. I mean,
so already I'm interested. for one, it's a local story. About the music industry.
Yeah.
And I would love, I would really love to hear about the differences between yesteryear and this year. And I actually want to bring you back and talk about that kind of thing.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we're running out of time. So I want to, before the outro music starts to play, I want to ask once again, how do people get a hold of you for Paradox Mastering?
They can go to, which makes no sense, but they can go to stellarrecordscanada.wordpress.com or they can just email me at paradox. Actually, just email me at glennallen1@live.
Cool. And we'll make sure all this is in the show notes. I want to thank you, Glenn, so much for coming by today.
Thanks
to
for having
us. And there is the outro music. It's been tons of fun.
Yes.
And I feel like we
barely scratched
the surface of getting into what we could talk about with you.
Yeah. So does that mean I'm coming back?
Yeah, absolutely. We're gonna have you back.
Okay, well, this is great.
And that's all we have for today.
Follow our hosts on Twitter at Two Bodies of Water.
I feel like we've gone off track. What were we talking about?
At Joey R. Engineer.
You got that mic in a comfortable spot yet?
I'm still working on it.
I know what I'm cutting.
You're an idiot, and I feel sorry for you.
Well, you say that every time, and every time I cut it.
On to the internet you go. Go switch off.